On the day after Hurricane Laura's assault on the northern Gulf Coast of Texas, what's the view from local hospitals already dealing with a pandemic? That story and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. More on the aftermath of Hurricane Laura. Also, it's a wrap for the Republicans as they close their four-day convention. We'll explore whether the message moved the needle in what many consider to be a more politically competitive Texas in 2020. Concerns about a looming eviction crisis. Also, border smuggling and the demand for baloney. The week it was in Texas politics and a whole lot more as the Texas Standard gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 28th day of August, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. We dodged a bullet, a sentiment heard again and again in East Texas on this Friday as residents on this side of the Sabine have been returning to their homes and discovering comparatively little damage from Hurricane Laura. Certainly compared to what happened right across the border, the story is much different in Louisiana. We'll have more on the effects of the storm in Texas a bit later in the broadcast. For the past couple of weeks, the National Democratic and Republican parties have been trying to make their case for the American people as we head into the final weeks of this presidential election season. Yes, November is approaching faster than most of us realize. Last night, the GOP wrapped up its national convention, and as we did after the DNC convention, we're asking on this morning after whether this event moved the needle in Texas. To help us with that, we're joined by veteran political analyst Mark Jones. He's a political science professor from Rice University. Professor Jones, thanks for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Quite a long speech last night on the South Lawn of the White House from President Trump, the Republicans nominee. Any key takeaways as you watched it?
Well, one that it went on and on and on. It was flatter than the president's normal speeches until the end, in part because he was reading primarily from a teleprompter. I think what we saw there are some of the messages we're likely to see in the upcoming campaign. A focus of Donald Trump is the only thing standing between chaos and violence and breakdown and law and order, contrasting his position with Democrats and highlighting the disorder, protests, and violence that have occurred in cities like Kenosha, Portland, Minneapolis, and New York City. We also saw a president who's going to try to say that the best is going to come because he can't make a claim that it already is here, given the economic problems we're experiencing and the COVID-19 difficulties. But he's going to try to project great economic growth in the future, as well as a vaccine or a resolution to the COVID-19 crisis. And we're likely to see some misleading rhetoric, both regarding where Democrats stand on many positions, as well as what has occurred with COVID-19, which was a topic that was danced around during the entire Republican National Convention.
I think something that struck me and struck a lot of viewers as well was the way that government institutions, and notably the White House, of course, was used as a kind of backdrop for the political messages, overtly political messages, that were part of this Republican National Convention.
Right. And that, I think that's just one more. There's been a criticism of President Trump throughout his administration for being unpresidential and doing things that have broken with protocol. This is just yet another one, using the White House as a prop for a national political convention. He would make the case that the time of COVID has changed everything, although the reality is he did use the White House as a prop for the accepting the nomination of the Republican Party, which is untoward, I think, in most people's views from a neutral perspective.
Let's pull back for just a moment, because I was reading some of the criticism, certainly in the national media, the New York Times saying seldom, if ever, has a political party spent so much time during a convention insisting explicitly that its nominee was not a racist or sexist, and sort of trying to suggest that Donald Trump was a person of empathy and good character. What's striking to me, though, is how much the base has not eroded for President Trump. And I'm wondering, as we look at Texas, which has been traditionally considered a red state in recent decades, at least, whether or not this message does anything here in Texas. Does it shore up his base in the suburbs? How do you see it breaking down?
Well, Donald Trump has been able to maintain his base throughout his presidency. He hasn't lost people, but he also hasn't added to that. And if we go back to the 2016 election that he narrowly defeated Hillary Clinton in, during an election when also Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, and Evan McMullen, an independent candidate, garnered a significant share of the vote, Trump actually needs to be expanding his base if he's going to defeat Joe Biden. You have both the independent voters and third-party voters from 2016, but also people who are coming into the voting public, younger people, many immigrants, many minorities who didn't vote back in 2016, and they are all leaning towards Joe Biden. And so for President Trump to win, it's not just enough to keep his base. He needs to expand it.
Not a lot of Texans playing a large role in the RNC this year. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick saying that means Republicans aren't worried about losing the state. You think that's true?
I think it has far more to do with where all these individuals fit in the Trump ecosystem, and that this was a this was a convention that was designed fully around President Trump. His family, it was unprecedented. His children spoke over an hour when you combined it all. Melania Trump, the first lady, spoke a half hour, the president himself 70 minutes. So this is really focused on the president, his family, his inner circle, within which there aren't many Texans, if any at all. And so it wasn't surprising that we didn't have many Texans. We really only had Congressman Dan Crenshaw for about 3.5 minutes. That was the sole token Texan in the lineup.
Mark Jones is a political science professor at Rice University. Professor Jones, thanks again.
Oh, thank you.
A lot of people struggling to cover bills right now in Texas. In July, a federal eviction moratorium expired. It didn't cover every rental unit, didn't even cover most, but it did prevent some landlords from evicting tenants as the economy collapsed. KERA's Christopher Connolly explains why housing experts are warning a wave of evictions is imminent.
Stuart Campbell thinks this fall could get bad, like really bad. He's a housing attorney for Legal Aid of Northwest Texas.
I think we don't have any idea what's going to happen, and that's scary.
From the end of March to the end of July, Campbell says a combination of the eviction moratorium plus a federal housing boost to unemployment checks and stimulus money kept many of the most vulnerable people from being evicted when they fell behind on rent because they lost work or got sick. What the moratorium didn't do...
It didn't itself forgive a tenant's contractual obligation to pay a rent. They still owe that rent.
By late July, more than a quarter of Americans had already missed a rent or mortgage payment, and a third of renters weren't sure that they could pay in August. Landlords in CARES Act-protected properties were free to start the eviction process. And that started a 30-day countdown, which ended this week.
The CARES Act was the dam, and instead of Congress adding to it or keeping it up, they've decided to knock it down, and so that wave is coming.
The National Low-Income Housing Coalition estimates that 30 to 40 million people in the U.S. are vulnerable to eviction this year. To put that in context, during the whole of the Great Recession, about 10 million people were foreclosed upon or evicted.
We're on the precipice of a housing crisis of really epic proportions that rivals really the Great Depression. And that's on top of, right, what is a public health crisis?
Lisa Alexander is a professor at Texas A&M School of Law who studies federal housing policy. She says new federal protections for renters are stuck in limbo as Congress and the White House remain at loggerheads over the next round of coronavirus relief. Democrats want more help for renters, Republicans not as much. And while the president has publicly supported extending the ban on residential evictions, the executive order he signed didn't actually do that.
Therefore, many people, if they're not living in a state or a county or a city that has enacted some kind of protection, they can be evicted now.
That describes most people in Texas, where a shortage of affordable housing meant nearly half of all renters were already paying more than they could afford before the pandemic hit. And Alexander says a history of racist housing policies have rendered people of color particularly vulnerable to eviction.
What has happened is that COVID-19 has just exacerbated the problems that existed before.
Landlords say extending an eviction moratorium just passes the burden of America's affordable housing shortage onto them. Ian Mattingly runs LumaCore, which operates 6,000 rental units in Texas. He says rental housing is a $1 trillion-a-year industry.
Even if it's only 15 or 20% of your residents who are not paying rent, I dare you to name an industry in the world that can take a 20% reduction in income and not have effects throughout the entirety of the economy.
Mattingly also heads the Apartment Association of Greater Dallas, and he's optimistic Congress will send more help. Meanwhile, he says landlords are working with people as much as they can.
I've seen members doing things that 6 or 9 months ago would probably have been unthinkable as far as payment reductions, deferrals, waiving late fees, and deferring evictions.
With all the talk of millions of looming evictions, legal aid lawyer Stuart Campbell says it's easy to lose sight of what evictions do to individual families.
It's a very traumatic experience when a man with a gun and a badge shows up after putting a red placard on your door and says, either you leave or I put you in cuffs and forcibly remove you from your home. And by the way, the landlord's here with a couple movers to put all your stuff on the curb.
As things stand right now, that's a trauma that one out of every 10 Texans could experience in the next few months. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
Joining us once again on this Friday with What Texans Are Talking About, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells. How you doing?
Howdy, David. And I'm doing well, and happy Friday to you.
Thank you.
No big surprise here. No big surprise here, but lots of folks sounding off about the president's acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention last night on the White House lawn. On our Facebook page, Mario Reyes speaks for several commenters when he says it was inappropriate for Trump to hold any campaign event at the White House. Keith Harris says this about the president's speech: he drew a line in the sand. However, Mark Cousy asks, what kind of message is that sending to Americans watching when only a handful of people in the crowd were wearing masks? And there is no mention of anyone, no mention anywhere in the speech of the over 180,000 Americans that have died this year from COVID-19. Obviously, lots of talk about that speech and several viral moments, videos from it percolating online there, David. It's just one story we're watching, and I'll be back with more from social later in the show.
Indeed, in about 35 minutes or so, and if we haven't heard from you on what's making news in your part of Texas, reach out to us, won't you? Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Coming up on 19 past the hour.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers keep seizing large loads of drugs on the Texas-Mexico border. Indeed, smuggling persists during the pandemic, but the contraband also includes a popular food item, Mexican bologna. KTEP's Angela Cochergo reports on a craving for bologna from Mexico on both sides of the border.
Customers at the La Mejor Texas Meat Shop in El Paso come for
calidad, producto fresco.
Quality, freshness, and good prices, says market manager Raul Burrell. The classic ranchera music, cuts of beef, and house marinades also provide a taste of Mexico. Miriam Ortiz is picking up some steaks and short ribs. But there's one thing this loyal customer cannot buy here or any other store in the U.S., Mexican bologna. The best-known brand is Chimex.
I love Chimex, you know, like, but they don't sell it over here, and it's very frustrating because we can't cross it either.
The bologna is not allowed across the border because it's made with pork and could introduce a foreign animal disease into the U.S. But that does not stop people from trying to slip it into the country. Catherine Vasquez is a U.S. Customs and Border Protection agriculture specialist in El Paso.
They smuggle it across because they're able to sell it, per se, under the table.
In the more than 20 years Vasquez has inspected products at border crossings, Mexican bologna persists as one of the most popular prohibited food items. The contraband comfort food in the form of red-colored rolls turns up time and time again.
They call them chubs, those round rolls.
The chubs weigh about 10 pounds each. While some are for personal consumption, larger quantities carefully concealed in cars and trucks are smuggled for profit. The price of a roll at least doubles once it crosses the border, according to Vasquez.
Up to $80 for one single roll.
Mexican bologna has turned up across Texas and the rest of the country. Some of those trying to sneak the sausages across the border these days are people who've lost their jobs during the pandemic, says Vasquez.
People who normally wouldn't do it are engaging in this type of smuggling activity.
Since May, CPB officers at border crossings in El Paso have seized at least 1,000 pounds of bologna. One man had 35 rolls hidden under blankets in the back seat of his SUV. Though the border is closed to essential travel, U.S. citizens can cross back and forth. The penalty for not declaring a commercial amount is a $1,000 fine.
Have you tasted this bologna yourself? Have you ever tried it?
No. I know that it takes forever to burn.
CPB officers destroy the bologna by incinerating it at ports of entry. And yes, it does smell like a big hot dog roast. Back at the La Mejor Texas meat shop, the manager points out the store has some great bologna in the deli section. But for customer Miriam Ortiz, who grew up eating the Chimex brand in Mexico, it's just not the same.
It doesn't have the same flavor. I don't know if it's because it's like Americanized. I don't know if it has the same ingredients. And over there, it's kind of like a reddish color. So I really don't know what's in there, but it's really good.
Even so, at this meat market, customers say there are plenty of other choices for those who crave the flavor of Mexico. Lauren Gore recently moved back to El Paso from Dallas.
I'll have to come back and do the carne al pastor, and then we're going to do some ribeyes for the grill, I think, as well.
In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocherga.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Hurricane Laura was the first major Category 4 hurricane to make landfall along the Texas coast since the beginning of the pandemic. So how did emergency medical teams and hospitals prepare for a natural disaster while trying to maintain safety precautions connected to COVID-19? We're joined now by Ryan Miller. He is Chief Operating Officer for Christus Health Southeast Texas, which runs St. Elizabeth Hospital in Beaumont. Mr. Miller, thanks for joining us on the Texas Standard.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Many, including our own Governor Abbott, using the phrase, we dodged a bullet. But what are you seeing coming through the doors of your hospital over the last 24 hours?
You know, we have dodged a bullet. And while we were prepared for whatever might come through the doors, it's been relatively quiet compared to what it could have been. So we're grateful for that.
Take us back to the days, the weeks prior to the storm. The pandemic's been ongoing for months, of course. And then here we were going into hurricane season. You're no stranger to hurricane season, living on the Texas Gulf Coast. But did you find that the coronavirus changed your preparations for this storm season?
You know, I wouldn't say it changed it for the storm season. To your point, we've got experience with storms through the years, but we're very grateful that we had months before to be prepared for coronavirus or to react to it. You know, I would have said that if we'd encountered a coronavirus at the very beginning of storm season, it would have been a different ball game. However, since we had the past 4 or 5 months with coronavirus, we had good protocols and pathways in place so that we could rely on those despite the storms coming before us. So we were in good shape.
It seems like to me, though, that even with coronavirus coming prior to storm season, you've also got to use a lot of your space somewhat more sparingly, right? I mean, you have greater separation between patients, and you also have rooms that are used by patients who are suffering from symptoms, right?
Absolutely. I would say in past storms, we were able to empty out more of our hospital in advance to transfer patients to hospitals that would not be in the impacted area. This time, we had a much fuller hospital going into it, and consequently, we brought in a lot more staff to care for them and did well.
If the storm had gone 10, 15 miles further west, as some had been predicting, it could have been a completely different scenario. How would you have dealt with that if, in fact, you had had more patients coming through the doors seeking treatment after the storm?
You know that we were prepared for that. We knew, I guess, the blessings of hurricanes as you can see them coming. And so you plan for the worst and you prepare for it and you pray for the best. And so in this case, we brought in staff in advance. We shelter them in place. So not only were we caring for 180, 200 patients, we had brought 200, 300 of our staff, having them shelter and sleep with us there so that no matter what happened during the storm, we could care for our patients. And that whatever came to us after the storm, we'd be ready for it.
Would you have had to have sent some of your patients perhaps to other facilities or get them out of the Beaumont area? I mean, is that even a possibility in the midst of the aftermath of a storm like that?
It is in the aftermath. You kind of have a window up to that point of the storm where you try to transfer patients out. And then during the storm, you hunker down and just react and adapt. And then after the storm, we find that services and resources, both in our immediate community and state and federal, really come together to help out. And so our experience with Harvey was there was a lot of extra help in the community and federal mm-hmm. resources that came to help us vacate.
So what do you anticipate over the next 48 hours? You got the weekend ahead, and then, of course, I think some people are somewhat fearful about the virus spread with evacuees from your area coming back home. How much of an issue is that as you see it?
You know, it's always a possibility. It's harder to maintain social distancing and protocols and things that will keep us safe when we're evacuating. At the same time, our plans as a hospital are unchanged. You know, as patients come to us, and if they're exhibiting symptoms of coronavirus, we have clear plans and pathways we put them on and to make sure that they're safe and that we're safe. We'll increase the number of patients we see. It's possible. We'll see. But we'll adapt to it as it goes.
Ryan Miller is Chief Operating Officer for Christus Health Southeast Texas, which runs St. Elizabeth Hospital in Beaumont. Thanks so much and stay safe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. Some of the thousands of people who evacuated to Austin away from Hurricane Laura are headed home this morning. A lot of them came from Galveston County, and that's one of the areas where evacuation orders have been lifted. But Austin's Emergency Management Director, Juan Manuel Ortiz, says some people may not be able to leave Austin for a while.
Those that are not going to be able to go back home in a timely manner, make sure that we have multi-agency resources centers open and working with our volunteer agencies to provide the resources that we can while they're staying here in the communities until they're able to go back home.
The city says it may consolidate shelters for people who need to stay in Austin long term. San Antonio and Dallas are also hosting evacuees from the storm. The filing deadline for candidates hoping to replace Republican State Senator Pat Fallon is tonight at 5. KERA's Rachel Osier-Lindley reports the emergency special election is for Texas Senate District 30.
The district in North Texas borders the Dallas-Fort Worth area and extends north to the Oklahoma border. Fallon, who's from Prosper, resigned to run for the congressional district previously represented by Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe. Ratcliffe recently vacated his seat to become the director of national intelligence. GOP State Representative Drew Springer says he's planning to run for the state Senate seat. So is Dallas salon owner Shelley Luther. Luther was briefly jailed in May for reopening her business early in violation of coronavirus pandemic regulations. The special election for Texas Senate District 30 is scheduled for September 29th. I'm Rachel Osier-Lindley in Dallas.
The home of the San Antonio Spurs, the AT&T Center, will serve as a polling site for the November general election. Local officials across Texas have been looking for facilities where voters can spread out and safely cast ballots during the coronavirus pandemic. Bexar County Commissioner Justin Rodriguez made the announcement last night.
I want to thank the Spurs organization, in particular RC and Coach Pop and Bobby Perez, their general counsel, to make the AT&T Center a mega voting site for the first time here in Bexar County.
The Harris County Clerk and the Houston Rockets also announced yesterday that the Toyota Center will be a polling location. NBA teams in several other states have also offered up their facilities as voting centers. Texas has the second most confirmed COVID-19 cases in the country, just behind California. Over 614,000 Texans have been infected, according to the latest data from Johns Hopkins University. Dallas and Harris counties rank among the top 10 in the United States for the most reported COVID-19 cases. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The answer to the question, how many people have contracted the coronavirus in Texas? Well, it depends on who you ask. State health authorities will give you one number. Individual counties will give you another. The discrepancy makes it difficult, to say the least, when it comes to gauging exactly how the virus has affected the Lone Star State, especially when Texas's modest number of contact tracers can't keep up with all the cases that come across their desk. Here to tell us more about what's behind all this, Alexandra Villarreal. She is a Texas-based freelance reporter for The Guardian. Alexandra, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been reporting on data dumps in the past, you know, sort of backlogs of information about who's getting the coronavirus and where. You've been writing about the problems we're having with data reporting and contact tracing. How would you contrast how contact tracing is supposed to work versus how it's actually happening here in Texas?
Well, when Governor Greg Abbott talked about the state's contact tracing effort in late April, as he announced Texas could begin the process of reopening, he actually used very specific language. He said that the contact tracing effort in Texas would box in the expansion of COVID-19. Contact tracers make contact with new cases, and then they trace their recent interactions to see who may have been exposed. So ideally, they're making contact quickly enough to stem infections within the community and avoid any major outbreaks. But during a nightmarish summer here in Texas, that apparatus fell apart, at least on the local level in some of the hardest hit communities. One county judge described what contact tracers in her area were doing during an inundation of cases earlier this summer as a reverse alert, which is obviously less effective. Part of that is turnarounds for testing. As Harvard professor of global health Ashish Jha told me, test results that come back after more than 72 hours are essentially useless for contact tracing. Tests are turning around quicker now, but the Texas Department of State Health Services said they still take 2 to 3 days to get results. And then just on the statewide effort, they turn around and contact new cases within about 24 hours. So altogether, that's right at the threshold of relevance, if not after.
Well, if that's happening, is it, I mean, it sounds like a lot of this data, that it's useless after that 72-hour mark passes. And yet, as I understand it, there are, what, 4,000 contact tracers in Texas? And many of those contact tracers already feel overwhelmed. Is this all for naught?
So it's not all for naught. There are just under 4,000 contact tracers, about half of them at local health departments, according to Texas Department of State Health Services, in the state of Texas as of last week. And even at the height of the pandemic here in Texas, both Jha and the Department of State Health Services made the point to say that any infections that are caught matter to the individuals. And if you can bring down that percentage of infections by even 20%, that is significant. It's just not the sort of cure-all or the solve that Governor Abbott made it seem when he announced reopening.
What did experts tell you about what Texas needs to fix? Is it in the reporting of the data at the local level? Do we need more contact tracers? As a practical matter, what needs to be done to get these local figures and state figures in line in a way that can actually make a difference?
Sure. What I heard about the discrepancies in data is that they are inherent to the way that the data is being collected. And so, for example, with fatalities, the state is using death certificates, whereas counties are relying on local reports from their hospital systems, etc. And so those discrepancies exist because of the methodology. And so it would take changing the methodology to have them align. Now, what I was told by Ashish Jha, the Harvard professor, was that he would likely rely more on the county data. And across the board, you know, counties talked about they trusted their data more just because it was usually more updated and more exact to their situation. So I don't know how exactly to align that data just because it is a methodological difference. But in terms of which numbers to trust, most experts seem to be leaning on that county data that I spoke to.
Alexandra Villarreal has been reporting on this story for The Guardian. We'll have a link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Alexandra, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard, and this is Tony Campbell with Wood and Wire, your local bluegrass-ish band, based right here in Central Texas. Our new record, No Matter Where It Goes From Here, is out today.
There's a gray-haired woman who's old and wise. Been around and around a long damn time.
Yeah, this is our fourth full-length studio record. Our last record, North of Despair, was sort of out of the blue, nominated for a Grammy in the bluegrass category. We were at the very end of the mixing process as the pandemic was beginning. Then once it became clear that no one really knew anything about this or when it was going to end or anything like that, we decided to actually push the release up earlier to give people music. We felt like during these weird times, some new music might bring a little bit of joy to people's worlds and something they could dig into and enjoy.
Pigs don't fly, we all gonna die, and you can't take your money to the grave.
We definitely feel lucky on a lot of levels. And you know, we're reevaluating how we're gonna make money for a while, whether it's getting day jobs or finding creative ways to make a living as a band. We're still figuring that stuff out. There are a lot of musicians out there that aren't in as fortunate of a place as we are. And I really hope that they find a way to survive for a while. But no matter what they do, I hope that when it's appropriate for us to get back playing shows, that they can get back on that horse, and I hope we can too. Until then, we just hope that this new record permeates and people listen to it and they enjoy it. And when we can play it live, they still want to hear the songs.
Brown water brushes up against boulders on Galveston Island sits my buddy. Damaged by floods that have come and have gone. He's a modern day Kerouac and wanna be Banksy, silent and settled, victim of time. Now the cold.
John was a really fun song for me to write. The actual John, my friend John, who I've known since I was 15. We're kindred spirits in that we both have sort of abnormal careers compared to many of the people we went to high school with.
Let it roll, let it ride, let it be.
So the song is about him and about his story, but it's really a love song to all the artists out there and anyone who works in sort of an abnormal industry. It may be difficult to get into, and it may be difficult to make it work, but this is just what I'm going to do, for better or for worse.
This Crystal Bay lap, it's a far cry from Houston, where all our old buddies wear coats and wear ties, and we'll raise up our glasses, because they're all kicking asses. Most folks ain't wired like John and I.
Yeah, El Paso is a really cool city, and I feel like it's kind of unknown to a lot of people in Texas or anywhere. So that song was written by Billy Bright, our mandolin player. He grew up in El Paso and went to high school there, and he loves it there. It's got this sort of funky groove and something a little different than we've done in the past, but it felt supernatural, and it didn't take long for us to come up with this arrangement.
My hometown goes along the river. My hometown is long and lean, 60 miles from east to west.
Hey y'all, this is Tony Campbell from Wood and Wire, your friendly neighborhood bluegrass band, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
My hometown was here before, they called it the USA.
Or Corno. 44 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. The reckoning over race since George Floyd's death has made many institutions, individuals, businesses, and local governments take a hard look at how they do things. Statues honoring Confederate figures have been removed. Products like Aunt Jemima rebranded. We're also seeing changes at institutions of higher education. McMurry University, which is a small private school in Abilene, is one such place. KACU's Dana Glover has their story.
McMurry was founded by James Hunt, a well-known Methodist educator, in 1923. Reverend Marty Cash Burles is the university's chaplain and director of religious life.
The start of the history is the start of the first president of McMurry, who grew up as the son of a missionary in a Native American community.
Cash Burles says that upbringing inspired Hunt to make the Indians the school's first mascot. In the early 1950s, the school leaned into that, starting a homecoming event called Teepee Village. Members of student clubs spent months learning facts about Native American tribes and built teepees on a university lawn. Club members dressed in costumes to greet guests from Abilene and beyond who'd come tour Teepee Village during homecoming week. It eventually became the central event of the university's calendar. This summer, though, University President Sandra Harper said the school was contacted by a tribe member who had concerns about the event. Ultimately, McMurray's Board of Trustees voted to end the Teepee Village permanently. In a video publicizing the school's decision, Harper explained,
"The practice of unaffiliated tribal members wearing costumes and telling the stories of the tribes could be perceived by some to be dishonoring the tribes."
McMurray alumni Elizabeth Balin disagrees with the board's decision.
"I understand where they were coming from with it. Now, I wouldn't be as upset about it if we didn't receive the tribe's blessings and work with them closely. It was hard. It was something that meant a lot to the students and the alumni."
Conversations on the university's Facebook page show Balin was one of dozens of McMurray alumni disappointed by the move. Balin says that extends beyond the campus.
"I personally believe that taking that away from the community hinders many more children from learning about these cultures and history."
Others support the decision and say it's another positive step for McMurray. The university had already made one significant cultural change in 2006. That year, the NCAA forced schools to drop mascots with insensitive references to minority cultures. University chaplain Cash Burles says McMurray's generic Indians mascot was one of those.
"So we couldn't really accurately reflect anybody."
In 2011, the university adopted the Warhawk mascot, something school leaders considered a nod to their founding history. Chaplain Cash Burles wasn't a part of that decision, but today she is part of a team working to honor the longstanding relationships the university has developed with Native American groups.
"I'm trying to figure out ways for us to respectfully put some closure on it, both for our alumni, who are very sad, somewhat irate, some of them, but also for the Native American communities that we've tried to represent.
Today, McMurray's student body is fairly diverse. More than 45% of its 1,200 students have a minority ethnic background. Vice President for Student Affairs Sam Ferguson says the university works to develop leadership skills that help students bridge gaps between unique experiences while acknowledging differences. He points to a partnership between students and staff called the Better Together Alliance. It's created things like a safe prayer room for Muslim students and supported the founding of a Black student union on campus. Those efforts are encouraging to student body president Jaquay Thomas.
As much as university promotes diversity, it has also had a humble check as well.
This summer, Thomas has been part of a reading group the school hosted where Black students can share their experiences with faculty.
Within those book readings, I can say that faculty and staff has honestly really been open to suggestions, really been open to listening.
Thomas is excited that students have returned to campus this week so more of this work can take place. He says it will be easier to evaluate what works and what doesn't when McMurray can get feedback from the whole campus community on how they can all make positive changes together. In Abilene, I'm Dana Glover.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
I'm Carrie Ann Holt, and I write poems on the spot with Typewriter Radio. Love thy neighbor. Who are we to know the plight of those behind closed doors? Who are we to bravely judge the things we do not know? If only we offered a simple wave from over here across the street. If only we left a note on a door to make sure everything is okay. There are many things to fear right now, so let's not fear each other. Loving thy neighbor isn't just kind. It could mean survival. I'm Carrie Ann Holt with Typewriter Rodeo, and you are listening to Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Typewriter Rodeo is on air each Friday here on The Standard, and it's always available in podcast form, too. We're taking poem requests on social media and at Texas Standard at KUT.org. Each Friday, we explore the week that was in Texas politics with the Texas Tribune. And joining us today, Patrick Svitek. He's political correspondent for the Trib. Patrick, happy Friday. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, top story in Texas this week's got to be Hurricane Laura, of course. Governor Greg Abbott was touring the damage along the Gulf Coast yesterday and got news that President Trump will also be in Texas this weekend, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The president said Thursday that he'd be heading to Texas as part of a multi-state tour this weekend. He said he would also be going to Louisiana and perhaps making a third additional stop somewhere. As of this morning, Friday morning, we're still waiting on more details from the White House, but it does sound like the president has plans to be in Texas this weekend to see the storm damage in southeast Texas and to probably meet with local officials.
Speaking of local officials, let's turn to what Governor Greg Abbott had to say about what he saw. Did anything stand out to you in his conversation with reporters?
You know, I think he just expressed, it was notable in that he just expressed a lot of relief that this the damage was not as bad as they had expected going into this. He said that he spoke with a lot of local officials who told him that they really felt that they, quote, dodged a bullet. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz was also at that press conference, and he said something along the lines of, you know, Texans today should be, you know, quote, breathing a giant sigh of relief. Things could have been much, much worse. But of course, you know, there are a lot of people nonetheless, you know, very much impacted by this storm. At the press conference on Thursday, Abbott said there were over 160,000 power outages still in the region of Texas that was hit by the storm. And so obviously there are people that were you know, seriously affected by this storm, but it sounds like it just wasn't you know, the damage and the overall impact on the Texas side of things just wasn't as bad as they'd anticipated.
Yeah. Finally, we learned this week about an upcoming special election to replace State Senator Pat Fallon. Why is this seat coming open, and what about the special election? Do we know details?
Right. It's a little complicated. So Pat Fallon, the incumbent, is poised to go to Congress. He was picked earlier this month by party insiders in the district to replace former Congressman John Ratcliffe on the November ballot. Because that congressional district is so reliably Republican, Pat Fallon is likely to win that election in November, meaning that there would be a vacancy in his state Senate seat. And just recently, just over, I think, last weekend, he went ahead and resigned that state Senate seat to try to get the process going to fill that state Senate seat as quickly as possible. Boy. And Governor Abbott moved very quickly to set what's called an emergency special election. And it's now going to be on September 29th to fill Pat Fallon's seat in the state Senate. And the filing deadline for that seat is this evening, is Friday evening at 5 p.m. So this is a very tight timeline to fill the state Senate seat. And I think that it was designed this way to try to get that seat filled before the legislative session and to probably try to get a state House seat filled if necessary, because one of the main candidates for the state Senate seat is State Representative Drew Springer. So a lot of political dominoes are falling here.
Yeah, sounds like it. Read all about it over at texastribune.org, where Patrick Svitek is political correspondent. Patrick, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar monitoring the talk of Texas on this Friday. Hi, Wells.
Hi, David. Good to be with you. And yes, good to be a Friday for sure. Hearing from lots of folks about the end of the week and how the drawing, with another week drawing to a close, we're very close to back to school for many listeners and friends of ours out there. And that doesn't even count the people that already have students back in school.
Already?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Shocking to hear. But we're hearing from folks about the issues that they anticipate. We got this tweet from K.P. Burling, who says this about back-to-school season. She notes that, "I'm glad one of my kids is in high school because I can't imagine having to keep two elementary school schedules straight from 9 to 9:30, then 10 to 10:30, then 2 to 3, referring to those synchronous learning periods that many school districts have where the kid is there with the teacher online. I suppose it's better than being online 6 hours straight," she offers. And of course, there's issues with higher education as well, with many people anxious about how that's going to go. I know here in Austin, there's been some viral photos, I guess, forgive the pun there, but photos of, I believe there is one photo of a sorority rush we saw this week of dozens and dozens of people standing together, close proximity, no mask. So, and of course, college football, the question of how that's going to play out. Via Facebook, Tim Cruz says that he's astounded that football will continue on campus. And he even notes that TCU, Texas Christian University, has an October 3rd game scheduled as we speak. So obviously a fast-moving situation, and one we've talked about a fair amount here on the show, but one that continues to capture folks' imaginations and concerns out there, David.
True indeed. You know, I'm just checking out the Texas Tribune's website. Terrific website. We were just talking with Patrick Svitek. There's a story that just moved within the hour while we were on the air. Alexa, you're writing that, you may recall, you may be aware that Texas is one of only, I believe, six states that has not opened up mail-in voting to any voter concerned about getting COVID-19 at a polling place. And earlier this week, Harris County announced, the clerk's office announced, it would be sending every registered voter in the county an application for a mail-in ballot. Well, now here's the news. Apparently, the director of the elections for the Texas Secretary of State told Harris County to immediately halt its plans to send every registered voter. And now the state attorney general is weighing in on this, too. Apparently, that may be premature, but it appears that the Secretary of State's office is threatening legal action if Harris County goes ahead with a plan to send applications for mail-in ballots to more than 2 million registered voters. So this is one of those developing stories, one of many stories we continue to track here at the Texas Standard. Keep up with all the news over the weekend at texasstandard.org, and we hope you have a good one.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.